In the last lecture, we met King James I and saw how he dealt with the ambiguities left behind by the Tudors over sovereignty within the English Constitution. In this lecture, we'll examine his handling of two additional areas of tension which threatened the Stuart state, those of government finance and foreign policy. Here, once again, the king's personality is going to play a crucial role, not least because of his tendency to give power and money to court favorites, in particular George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham. As we'll see, Buckingham would rise to power and wealth unheard of in a favorite since Wolsey. Unlike that unfortunate cardinal, the Duke would maintain his power into the next reign, that of James's son, Charles I, with dire consequences for the fiscal and foreign policy of England. The problem of royal finance represented a second long-term area of tension between the king on the one hand and his parliament and people on the other. Now, if you've been following this course, you know that this is a problem of long standing. English kings have almost always been poor, certainly continuously since the reign of Henry VIII. So, in other words, it's not exactly James's fault, for example, that he came to the throne in the midst of the inflation described in Lecture 20, or that his reign was bracketed by two periods of famine, the 1590s and the 1620s. It wasn't James's fault that he inherited a central administration and revenue system that was ramshackle, inefficient, and corrupt. Because he couldn't pay his servants adequately at the center, they looked out for themselves. They took bribes, they took fees, they even bought and sold offices. Because he couldn't pay his servants in the countryside at all, sheriffs, JPs, and tax collectors often felt that it was more important to get along with their neighbors than to do the king's business. And so, for example, in collecting taxes, they'd undervalue the wealth of their fellow landowners. It wasn't James's fault, or at least it was not a fault in James, that unlike Elizabeth, he had a wife and children. Most people thought this a good thing after the uncertainty about the succession during the whole of Elizabeth's reign. But of course, each member of the new royal family would need their own court and palatial accommodation, and that was going to cost money. It wasn't James's fault that he inherited an expectant and rapacious court that was anxious for a more generous royal patron after his miserly predecessor. And it wasn't James's fault that that predecessor left him a royal debt of £365,000, or a little over a year's expenditure. But it was James's fault that having spent most of his life ruling a relatively poor country, he viewed England as a ship that had just come in. In his own words, he said that he had been like a poor man wandering about 40 years in a wilderness and barren soil, and now arrived at the land of promise. It was James's fault that he decided to make up for lost time by spending English money like water. He built magnificent buildings like the Banqueting House at Whitehall and the Queen's House at Greenwich. We learned about that in a previous lecture. He staged elaborate masks. He spent money on his court and on his favorites. To give you just one example, the expenses of the Great Wardrobe, this is the household department that provides furniture, increased 400% from what they had been under Elizabeth. By 1610, James I had spent nearly £250,000 on the hungry Scots, the Scots courtiers that came down with him when he ascended the throne. As a result, annual royal expenditure skyrocketed. It had been about £300,000 in wartime under Elizabeth. It was £500,000 in peacetime under James. The royal debt skyrocketed too. They went from £365,000 in 1603 to £600,000 in 1608, and then to £900,000, three times James's annual revenue, by 1618. Now, as you know, as anyone who's ever been short of money, as my students know, there are only two possible solutions to this problem. You're either going to have to get daddy to pay more money, in this case Parliament, or you're going to have to cut your expenditure. Both would be difficult. Take raising revenue. This was difficult because Parliament knew how James spent his money, and they weren't about to facilitate his pleasures any more than they had already done. Government attempts to get Parliament to cough up more money in 1610, 1614, and 1621 all failed. The 1614 attempt is one of my favorites. This Parliament actually accomplished nothing and came to be known as the Addled Parliament. Now, the man in charge of trying to get James more money was Elizabeth's old Secretary of State, Robert Cecil, whom James named Earl of Salisbury and Lord Treasurer. He attempted to increase yields from revenue in three ways, from existing revenue. First, he tried to reform the crown lands. The problem with this was there were hardly any crown lands left to reform. Second, Salisbury sold titles of honor, peerages, and a new office created just for this purpose, that of baronet. This, of course, did bring in money, but it cheapened the nobility. Finally, Salisbury changed the rates at which customs were collected and applied duties to products upon which there had not previously been customs. He did this without parliamentary permission. This came to be known as the impositions, and it was wildly unpopular. So all three of these methods to increase revenue have their problems. What about decreasing expenditure? This was hard because favorites and courtiers fought hard against it. They lived in the lean times under Elizabeth. James had been like a sugar daddy to them. They didn't want the flow of money and gifts to stop. And James I himself was of a very generous nature. By 1621, fast forward 10 years, Robert Cecil, Earl of Salisbury, the one man who might have restrained the king, was dead. He died in 1612, worn out with care. The king's debt stood at £1 million. City loans were drying up, and the government was firmly in the hands of a royal favorite who wanted no part of economy, George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham. Who was he? Where did he come from? Well, to talk about Buckingham, I have to talk about the favorites and James's propensity to surround himself with favorites. As you'll recall, early in the reign, James I came south with the Hungry Scots, a group of courtiers from his northern kingdom who profited from his generosity and England's wealth. The most prominent of these was Robert Carr, Earl of Somerset. Between 1607 and 1613, James lavished lands and offices on Somerset. Now, Somerset wasn't really politically ambitious. He was more socially ambitious. And the capstone to that ambition was a socially prominent marriage to the well-connected but notoriously promiscuous Frances Howard, Countess of Essex. Now, there were problems with the marriage. First, there was the problem that the Countess of Essex was already married to Robert Devereux, 3rd Earl of Essex. He's the son of Elizabeth's ill-starred favorite. Moreover, the match was opposed by Somerset's best friend and advisor, Sir Thomas Overbury, who threatened to reveal damaging secrets about the couple if the marriage went forward. But with James's help, the ambitious couple solved their problems. First, the Countess secured a divorce from the Earl of Essex on the grounds that he had been unable to consummate their marriage for 5 years because he had been bewitched. Now, the difficulty here was proving it. As proof, she submitted the results of a farcical physical examination, which purported to demonstrate, to the complete astonishment of the court, that she was, in fact, a virgin. Everyone was shocked. As for Overbury, he had offended the king on a number of accounts, and he ended up in the Tower of London, where he very conveniently died. Are you beginning to sense that maybe the court of James I was not exactly a monastery? The marriage went ahead in the presence of the king in 1613. But within several months, it emerged that Overbury had been poisoned, and that the Countess had ordered the poisoning. Now, even James's court couldn't look the other way on this one. The Somersets were convicted as accessories to murder in 1616. James eventually pardoned them, but their court careers were over. The damage to the court's reputation and finances was immense. Still, by the time of his fall, Somerset had already been eclipsed by another favorite. In 1614, the king was introduced to a young courtier from a minor gentry family named George Villiers. Villiers had all the attributes of the successful courtier. He was handsome. He was courtly. That is, he was well-behaved and knew how to behave. He was an excellent dancer and horseman. He was also given credit for being highly intelligent. Historians have charged him with vaulting ambition and an absence of scruples. In any case, James fell in love with these qualities in his steenie, as he called Villiers, probably a reference to St. Stephen, who martyred himself for the love of Christ. The thought was that steenie, George Villiers, would be willing to be a martyr for the love of James. He seems to have loved his steenie as fully as Elizabeth had fallen for her sweet Robin. given contemporary attitudes to kingship and sexuality, this did nothing for James's image with the English people. James showered Villiers with titles and offices. I'll read to you the prologue to Villiers's impeachment from several years later, which begins, "George, Duke, Marquess, and Earl of Buckingham, Earl of Coventry, Viscount Villiers, Baron of Wadden, Great Admiral of the Kingdoms of England and Ireland and the Principality of Wales, General Governor of the Seas and Ships of the said Kingdom, Lieutenant General, Admiral, Captain General, and Governor of His Majesty's Royal Fleet and Army lately set forth, Master of the Horse of our Sovereign Lord the King, Lord Warden, Chancellor and Admiral of the Cinque Ports, and of the members thereof, Constable of Dover Castle, Justice and Ire of the Forests and Chases on this side of the River Trent, Constable of the Castle at Windsor, Gentleman of His Majesty's Bedchamber, one of His Majesty's most honorable Privy Council in his realms, both in England, Scotland, and Ireland, and Knight of the Most Honorable Order of the Garter." When the historian Conrad Russell reprinted that list, there's a little footnote that says one of the charges against Buckingham was the encroachment of offices. Yeah. Now, the titles were pleasant, and the offices were lucrative. But the most important thing about them was that they gave Buckingham control of a vast field of government patronage. By the 1620s, Buckingham was as important a patron, had as much of a stranglehold on patronage within the English government as Wolsey had done, which means that virtually everyone in government was somehow owed their allegiance, their loyalty, their job to Buckingham. By the way, you've noticed I've started calling him Buckingham. He was created Duke in the 1620s. This also meant, of course, that since Buckingham's power increased with the size of his patronage, he would not be very receptive to the idea of reducing the size of the government, which you'll remember from the king's financial difficulties is something they really had to do. When the crown's debts reached £1 million and city loans started to dry up in the 1620s, Lord Treasurer Middlesex attempted to cut expenditure. And for a while, he succeeded until he started cutting into Buckingham's patronage. At that point, Buckingham and his cronies in the House of Commons and House of Lords engineered an impeachment for Middlesex, reviving an old medieval custom that hadn't been used in some time. Buckingham would eventually regret that precedent. Middlesex was impeached in 1624. He tried to fight back by finding another teenage boy whom the king might fall for and thrusting him into the bedchamber, but James remained loyal to his Steenie, and so Middlesex fell, and Buckingham remained ascendant. As this implies, as the king slowed down in the 1620s, he began to forget himself in hunting and hanging around with the Duke, and the Duke began to make policy. As James told his council, "Christ had his John, and I have my George." Buckingham's greatest and arguably most disastrous influence was in the area of foreign policy. Now, during the early years of the 17th century, English men and women were engaged in a debate about foreign policy, specifically about England's relationship to Europe. It's the same debate that had been going on for 500 years, and it's still going on today. James I contributed to that debate by fancying himself a Rex Pacificus. That is, he intended to bring peace not only to the English and the Scots, but to all the peoples of Europe. Soon after his accession, he negotiated the Treaty of London, which ended the war with Spain that Elizabeth had been unable to end. Subsequently, he sought to ease tensions between the Catholic and the Protestant powers by engineering diplomatic marriages. His master plan was that his son, his eldest son, Prince Harry, would marry the Infanta of Spain. His daughter, Elizabeth, would marry the Protestant Frederick V, Elector Palatine, who was one of the leaders of the Protestant movement in Europe. Thus James would be the bridge between the Catholic and Protestant sides. Well, unfortunately, Henry died of typhoid fever in 1612, and the Palatine marriage took place, but in 1618, the elector was driven from his lands by a Spanish army during the Thirty Years' War. We have to spend some time with the Thirty Years' War because it's the biggest event happening in Europe at this time. It was one of the great tragedies in European history. It lasted from 1618 to 1648. It pitted the Habsburgs, that is Spain and the Holy Roman Empire and their Catholic allies, against the Bourbons, France, and their Protestant allies, Denmark, Sweden, and some of the northern German states. Now, on one level, the 30 Years' War is the last of the wars of religion. It's Spain's last chance to crush Protestantism. But on another level, the fact that France fought on the side of the Protestants should tell you something. It was also a very modern war. It was a war about the balance of power in Europe between a rising France and a fading Spain. Now, in the end, what you need to know about the 30 Years' War was it devastated Central Europe, it wrecked the Spanish economy, and it killed millions. From this point, both the Holy Roman Empire and Spain would enter their long period of decline, while France would eventually emerge the most powerful nation in Europe. Where does England fit in? Obviously, James was quite wise to stay out of this quagmire. But committed Protestants in Parliament wanted England to get involved. They saw England as a Protestant nation, a chosen nation, whose job it was to advance international Protestantism. And so they needed to get involved in the 30 Years' War. To them, James's pacifism was cowardly and disgraceful. James and Buckingham convened a Parliament in 1621 to discuss the issue. Specifically, they wanted money to raise an army to restore the Elector Palatine, Elizabeth's husband, to his ancestral lands. But this Parliament met in the midst of another economic recession. Parliament's always meeting in the midst of an economic recession. You figure this out by now. It wanted to abolish monopolies, it wanted an end to the impositions, and it wanted a full-scale naval war against Spain. By the way, you'll notice that those desires are completely incompatible. On the one hand, they want their taxes to go down, and on the other hand, they want a war. James responded with a page out of Elizabeth's book. He told them that they had no business debating foreign policy. That was a matter of state. This led to a famous controversy about free speech, in which the Commons lodged a formal protest that revived some of the arguments of the Apology of 1604. They asserted that the liberties, franchises, privileges, and jurisdictions of Parliament are the ancient and undoubted birthright and inheritance of the subjects of England, and that the arduous and urgent affairs concerning the king, state, and defense of the realm and of the Church of England, and the maintenance and making of laws and redress of mischiefs and grievances which daily happen within this realm, are the proper subjects and matter of counsel and debate in Parliament. We have to be able to discuss these things. James responded by sending Parliament home, by imprisoning some of his leaders, and by ripping this protest from the pages of the Commons Journal with his own hand. Of course, in doing so, he didn't solve the issue. He only made it worse. In fact, James and Buckingham's real purpose was not so much to fight a war against Spain. They wanted this army as a bargaining chip. Their plan was to persuade Spain that Spain didn't want to fight a war against England. Instead, what Spain really wanted to do was marry the Spanish Infanta, the Crown Princess of Spain, with the remaining son of King James, Prince Charles. In the winter of 1622-23, Buckingham reopened negotiations for a Spanish match over the objections of a hostile people. Nobody in England wanted a Spanish marriage. They remembered the marriage of Philip II and Mary. They also remembered the Protestant martyrs and the Armada and the gunpowder plot, which we'll talk about in the next lecture, and Spanish atrocities in the 30 Years' War. This was terribly unpopular. It wasn't popular in Spain either. Spain thought they could do better than England. England still wasn't terribly important. And so when Buckingham and Charles asked for diplomatic passage to Spain, diplomatic credentials, they were refused. But our heroes were not deterred. Instead, they decided to go to Spain incognito. The result was a diplomatic fiasco. Armed with false beards and calling themselves Thomas and John Smith, the prince and the duke turned up in Spain. The Spanish knew who they were. Nobody was fooled. They were forced to take the distinguished but anonymous visitors to a bullfight, a tour of the royal art collection, but they wouldn't let them anywhere near the Infanta. This led to a famous incident in which Prince Charles actually climbed a garden wall to get a look at his inamorata. In the end, our intrepid heroes were forced to return to England without their prize, to the cheers of a populace that thought that it had been delivered once again from the Catholic menace. For the first and only time in their lives, Charles and Buckingham were popular. There were bonfires in London, bells rang in all the churches. Now, in fact, the Spanish fiasco had two very important results. The first was that it gave Buckingham an opportunity to cultivate Prince Charles. It was very clear that James I was slowing down. He would die in March of 1625, and Buckingham would remain the principal favorite of the new monarch, Charles I. What was the new king like? In many ways, Charles I looked and acted much more like a divine right king than his father had done. He was relatively short, but he bore himself with regal dignity, as seen in several paintings by Van Dyck. He also maintained a strict court etiquette, which contrasted with his father's loose informality. In another contrast, his personal morality was strict and conventional, and he kept a respectable court. He was highly cultured, arguably the greatest connoisseur who ever sat on the English throne. As we mentioned in Lecture 27, he sent his diplomats through Europe to bring back great artwork from its great capitals. It was at Charles's insistence that Rubens and Van Dyck came to England. From the former, he commissioned the banqueting house ceiling, depicting his father's ascent into heavenly glory. From the latter, he commissioned a series of paintings of the royal family, which are one of the great monuments of Western art and kingly propaganda. But as with Henry VIII or Mary I, each of these positive qualities had its dark side. Charles's dignity often came across as aloofness. He was a shy and reticent man, and he never had the common touch. His punctiliousness was, in fact, the bugbear of a small mind. He was obsessed with etiquette, order, and obedience from all his subjects. He wanted everybody to think the same way. He hated diversity of opinions, and he saw all disagreement as disloyalty. As a result, his respectable court was also narrow and unrepresentative of the variety of opinions in the country. The court should be a place of contact between the king and everybody, and Charles I's court wasn't. He never took advice or understood the concept of a loyal opposition. Instead, Charles I was full of his divine right to rule, expecting instantaneous obedience from his subjects without any need to explain himself, either to his people or his parliament. He felt no need, for example, to engage in the sort of propaganda campaign that Elizabeth had done. Even his magnificent art collection, therefore, had a downside. Only courtiers ever got the message. They're the only ones who saw these magnificent pictures of the king showing him to be God's chosen, but the whole country had to pay for it, and they resented that. The second important result of the Spanish fiasco was that it brought Buckingham and Charles over to the war party. Insulted, Buckingham goes to Parliament in 1624 and demands war with Spain. Now, Parliament votes the money. They want war with Spain, but they don't vote as much money as Buckingham asks for. James I would later say, they voted enough to make a good beginning of the war. For what the end will be, God knows. By the way, I must apologize for playing fast and loose with dates. You notice that James is now revived briefly at the beginning of this war, but don't worry, he'll still die in March of 1625. The war actually began before his death. By the way, Parliament also established a commission to see how the king spent, whichever king it would be, how the king spent the money they voted. That's a sign of tremendous distrust of the monarch's financial responsibilities. In fact, both James and Parliament were quite right to be wary, for Buckingham proved to be an incompetent war minister, and his administration proved corrupt and inefficient in several pointless continental expeditions. Soldiers and sailors complained of rotten food and decrepit ships. At one point, the Royal Navy was actually forced to use sails that had first seen service during the Armada. At home, the people complained of high taxes, the imposition of martial law, the billeting of troops on their homes. The recorder of Taunton protested, "Every man knows there is no law for this. We know our houses are our castles." In Buckingham's defense, it must be said that he was never given enough money to fight a proper war. The king needed about £1 million a year if he was going to fight Spain successfully. But in 1625, Parliament only voted one-fifth of that amount. Worse, late in 1626, Buckingham bungled into a second, simultaneous war with France over shipping rights and the treatment of the Huguenots. Now, if you've been following this course, you know that the Tudors were not always wise in their choice of enemies and certainly fought a number of unnecessary wars. But no Tudor had ever been stupid enough to take on the two most powerful nations in Europe at the same time. Needless to say, this war, too, went badly, culminating in a botched amphibious assault on the Isle of Rhé off La Rochelle between June and October of 1627. If you've ever read The Three Musketeers, you know about this incident. Even before this, in 1626, the House of Commons began to call for Buckingham's impeachment. To shield his favorite, Charles took two drastic actions. First, he took responsibility for the failures of the war himself. He said, it's my fault, it's not Buckingham's fault, leave him alone. Now, this will probably strike you as being a very generous thing for the king to do, but it was also a profoundly stupid thing for the king to do, because it broke an ancient tradition which said that anything went wrong was always the minister's fault. It was never the king's fault. The king can do no wrong. Henry VIII had reveled in that principle. What Charles has done is he's now saying to his people, if you have a problem with the country, blame me. It's my fault. Big mistake. Charles's second move was to prorogue Parliament before they could impeach Buckingham or vote any new taxes. So in other words, he's allowing his financial situation to deteriorate, and maybe lose the war, in order to protect his friend and favorite. Without authorization for new taxes, the king resorts to an old Tudor expedient. He declares a forced loan. He says to his wealthiest subjects, you're loaning me money. In the end, this yielded £260,000. That helped. But it wasn't enough. The king was going to have to call Parliament again. Worse, 76 gentlemen refused to pay the loan, charging correctly that it was an unparliamentary tax. Would they have done that with Henry VIII? Charles threw them into prison without charge, since in fact they had violated no law. This prompted five of them, all knights, to sue for a writ of habeas corpus. You've got to charge us if you're going to put us in prison. In the end, the king's judges refused to rule on the five knights' case. That was considered a moral victory for the knights. In effect, the judges don't want to address the issue in law because they know the king has broken the law. Now we go back to the problem of sovereignty. See how finance and sovereignty are connected. The Parliament of 1628 met in an angry mood. Some of the imprisoned gentlemen actually won seats. They all feared that if they voted money for an army, Charles I would use it not against Spain or France, but against recalcitrant Englishmen to suppress their liberties. Their position was they would not approve any taxation until the king had heard their grievances. And so they offered the king five new taxes if he would only agree to a document called the Petition of Right. Petition of Right of 1628 is a very important document. It states, first, no man can be forced to pay a tax not voted by Parliament. Second, no free man can be imprisoned without charge, the right of habeas corpus. Third, no soldiers or sailors can be billeted on the population without their consent. And fourth, no civilian can be subject to martial law. If you're familiar with the points at issue during the American Revolution, this will all sound very familiar. Charles tried to weasel out of it, but in the end, he couldn't. He needed the money too desperately, and so he agreed. At that point, the Commons turned around and said, right, and we want to impeach Buckingham, and so the king sent Parliament home again. Once again, the king had lost a chance for more money in order to save Buckingham. But there were limits to the extent to which Charles I could protect his favorite. That summer, while going down to the fleet, the Duke was assassinated by an embittered army officer named John Felton. This had three profound effects. First, it further served to distance Charles I from his subjects. He considered the assassination of Buckingham a barbaric act. What did his subjects do? They celebrated it with bonfires and bells. Second, the death of Buckingham did remove the principal architect of the war against France and Spain, thus making peace possible. Third, it left the king without a principal advisor. Many assumed that he would now turn to his wife, Queen Henrietta Maria. That was a problem to many English men and women, because Henrietta Maria was a Roman Catholic. In this lecture, we saw how James I's devotion and generosity to favorites, most importantly, George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, aggravated pre-existing tensions over the crown's finances and its foreign policy. In some ways, James's problem was timing. He tried to be a bountiful king out of an antiquated and inadequate financial system in the midst of a poor economy. He wanted to be a pacific king at the height of the wars of religion. As a result, James's finances collapse just as the international situation threatens to suck England to a very big war that undoubtedly England doesn't have the financial resources to win. The result will be an intensification of ancient debates in Parliament and elsewhere about taxation and England's role in Europe. So the problems of crown finance and England's foreign policy became intimately bound up with those of sovereignty and the king's personality. In the next lecture, we'll add yet another area of tension to the mix, that of religion.